From the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello and welcome to the Huffines Institute of Sports Medicine and Human Performance weekly audio podcast. We're so glad that you took the time to join us, to take the time to download us and listen. And we are so happy to have another special guest with us. Today we have Dr. Mickey Collins, who is the director of the University of Pittsburgh's Medical Center Sports Medicine Concussion Program. This program was founded in 2000, and it was the first research and clinical program that focused on the diagnosis, evaluation, and management of sports-related mild traumatic brain injury. Dr. Collins has a PhD in clinical psychology from Michigan State University, and we're so glad you could join us today, Dr. Collins. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks.
We're going to just jump into this. There's so much interest right now in sports concussions. What drew you to this general area of concussion research?
Well, I was an athlete back in the day, washed up now. However, I played collegiate baseball and played a lot of sports way back. Always an athlete, always think you will be. But, you know, I also became fascinated with the brain when I was in college and went on to get my degree in clinical neuropsychology. And I was studying the brain and I was fascinated by it, but something was missing. And I realized that sports was missing out of that equation. And so I was able to do something that not a lot of people get to do, and that's combine sports with the brain and two significant passions for myself. And you know, I first started getting into this area back in the mid to late 1990s, and that was the time that Troy Aikman and Steve Young were having problems. And I watched with interest their difficulties and had heard over and over again from people reporting on their cases that there was very little known about concussion at the time. And I said to myself, boy, that's something I can do, because I was studying the brain and learning about mild traumatic brain injury in my coursework. And at that point, I started doing some research right at that time. And little did I know that 15 years later, this would be the hottest topic in sports medicine.
Yeah. Yeah, it really has exploded over the last couple of years. We've talked a couple times to Dave Epstein, who's a writer with Sports Illustrated. He's written several pieces about concussions, primarily in youth sports. How prevalent are concussions in youth-level sports?
Well, it's a little scary, but the CDC is reporting that there's between 1.6 to 3.8 million concussions occurring per year in this country.
Wow.
In sports and recreation alone. And quite frankly, I believe that. It's something that is ubiquitous. It's something that's, you know, and a lot of people ask, how in the world could this be going on? When I played sports when I was a kid, you know, I got my bell rung and they put me back to play and everything was fine. Well, we've learned more in the past 5 or 10 years than the previous century before that time in terms of our knowledge of concussion. And what we used to think were quote-unquote bell ringers are actually concussive events. And, you know, the symptoms that one experiences with getting their bell rung is caused from a pathophysiologic response in the brain, and these abnormalities are what's causes the symptoms. And if you play through that stuff, you can start going down a road you don't want to go down. So, you know, seemingly innocuous events can actually end up being quite serious if they're not managed carefully. And I think that I don't think the injury is increased in prevalence as much as our knowledge of the injury is increased. And because of that, the numbers of concussions have gone up simply because we have a better understanding that these symptoms are concussion related.
Yeah, just our awareness of it.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's coming up football season now, and football may be one of the biggest sports for concussions. I was reading a study recently where they were putting accelerometers into helmets in high school players, and it was just amazing the G-forces that some of these guys' heads were taking. Has the helmet technology improved? Are they hitting more? Why does there seem, you said that you think that the number of concussions has always kind of been stable and that we're just now becoming more aware of that. Was that true back in the 30s and 40s when they wore leather helmets?
Well, the word concussus literally translates from Latin to English to mean to shake violently. Think about the brain as an egg yolk inside an eggshell, with the egg yolk being the brain, the egg white being the spinal fluid, and the eggshell being the cranium. What causes concussion is either angular, rotational, or translational linear forces that are impacted on the head. And I don't care what you're wearing around your head. It could be a tank. You cannot stop the brain from moving inside the skull. And when the brain moves inside the skull, if you don't mind, let me discuss with you what happens to cause a concussion, because I think it's very informative for everyone to understand. Because most people think concussion, oh, it's a bruise to the brain, or it's swelling,
right,
or there's something, you know, but none of that. And what a concussion is this, and I'm going to get a little technical, so be patient, but here's what happens when we have a concussion. When the brain moves inside the skull, what ends up happening is inside the brain we have billions of cells called neurons. There's more neurons in our brain than there are stars in the sky, and each neuron is connected by an axon. And what controls our behavior as human beings is one cell talking to another cell, and the way these cells communicate is through these chemicals that are released out of the cell and into the cell. Well, when we have a concussion, there's a certain chemical inside the cell called potassium, and when the brain moves inside the skull, the membrane to the cell will get stretched.
Mm.
And when that membrane gets stretched, the potassium, which is supposed to be inside the cell, will leak out of the cell.
Mm. So you're rupturing the cells almost.
You're actually stretching the cells.
Mm.
So it's
okay.
Not rupturing, it's more stretch. And at that point, when the potassium gets leaked out of the cell, there's an increased demand for energy. So the brain is demanding more energy. At the same time, however, there's a second very important chemical called calcium, which is supposed to be sitting outside the cell, that will stretch across the same membrane, go into the cell. When that occurs, our blood vessels actually constrict. And what provides energy to the brain is blood. So at the very time the brain is demanding more energy, we actually get reduced cerebral blood flow, and therefore we get less supply of energy. And so all concussion is these cells are starved for energy, and because of that, they don't communicate to each other as well. And depending on what systems in the brain we have, what systems in the brain that are affected, we get different symptoms. You know, there's 22 different types of symptoms we see with concussion, you know, ranging from headaches to fatigue to dizziness to vision changes to nausea to light sensitivity, noise sensitivity, mood changes, sleep problems, thinking problems, etc. But what we know about concussion, this is the best part of my job, is that if you let the brain recover, that membrane will get back to normal, the potassium will go back in the cell, the calcium will go back out of the cell, and everything can return to normal. And in fact, most of the time, you can hit the reset button on these athletes.
Mm. So they can recover?
Absolutely, unequivocally, yes. They can and they should, because if they're not recovered, and this process is still going on, and this membrane is still stretched, and these chemical changes are still taking place, there's two things that you don't want to do. Number one is get hit in the head again.
Right.
If you get hit in the head again when this is going on, a lot less biomechanical force is going to cause more serious problems. And that's when you start going down a road where you can't come back from. If you completely, you know, challenge the cell with more trauma when it's trying to recover from the first trauma, that can result in serious consequences. Now, the second thing you don't want to do is, because the cells are starved for energy, you got to be very careful about increasing the demand for energy too quickly. So kids that work out during concussion,
mm-hmm.
if they are in school studying for physics tests, calculus tests, going to math class and having a hard time, I mean, if you're pushing yourself through this either cognitively or physically, you're just robbing the brain of the energy it needs to recover. Now, that doesn't mean you have to sit in a dark room. However, you got to be mindful of not pushing through this. You know, if you start working out, start feeling symptoms, and just working out harder is going to make your recovery last longer. So, you know, a lot of people don't understand that this is a completely manageable event, and there is a recovery point. And when that recovery point occurs, I am the biggest football fan in the world. I'm putting those athletes back on the field as soon as they're recovered. It's just, if they're not recovered, you're going to run into problems with this. And it's something that I know coaches, et cetera, that don't have a good understanding of these issues sort of look at this and say, well, when I played football, you know, they put me right back out and I was fine. But if anyone followed me for a day in clinic and see what I see on a daily basis, it would scare that person. It's very scary what can happen with this injury, and I see it every day.
Yeah, and it seems to be such a paradox, especially when you're talking about student athletes who maybe in a game on Friday night or Saturday and they have a mild traumatic injury, and then on Monday they're expected to go back to class and function normally. And there's been some report of some visual impairments, isn't there, along with some of the concussion?
Yeah, that's the one symptom. You did a good job there. That's the one symptom I didn't mention in my little list earlier, is that vision. And 70% of the brain's devoted to vision.
Mm.
And these cells that are throughout the brain that have to connect to each other to, for the vision system, visual system to work. If 70% of the brain is devoted to vision, it makes sense that when you have cellular disruption, that system is going to be affected more than other systems. And we see definite problems with one of the things we're finding to be very common with this is difficulty converging your vision. So bringing your eyes together, just seeing what we call convergence and accommodation and sufficiency where the eyes aren't coming together appropriately. And because of that, kids get headaches when they read or when they study, they have to work on a computer. And we're actually coming up with treatments for that. There's a lot going on treating that system. So that's something we will commonly see with the injury, yes.
Wow. So when do you know when they're ready to go back, ready to return to play?
I've spent my entire career studying and clinically evaluating that issue. We have very specific criteria. And one thing that people have to understand is that the recovery rates from this injury are incredibly variable. We have some kids that can get better in a day or two. Some kids take a week, some kids take 3 weeks, some kids take 6 months, some kids never get better, okay?
Wow.
And if you think you could say, sit out a week, you'll be okay, sit out 2 weeks, you'll be okay, anytime I hear a clinician that says that, I immediately know the clinician has no earthly idea what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot predict recovery with this event. In other words, if you ever get a clearance note from an emergency room and the emergency room says patient didn't lose consciousness or whatever and CT scan was normal, you know, go back to play in a week, take that clearance note from that physician, rip it up and flush it down the toilet because you can't predict this thing at the time of the injury, number one. Okay.
Wow.
Number two is that CT scans and MRIs do not show these issues I'm just talking about with concussion. A CT and MRI is always normal with concussion, okay? Now, a CT and MRI is very important to rule out something that's life-threatening, like a bleed or a skull fracture, and emergency rooms do an excellent job of ruling life-threatening conditions out, but they can't manage concussion in the emergency room.
So a CT scan or MRI really doesn't help you with degrading the severity of the concussion at all?
No, you don't see it. These chemical changes that I'm talking about, there's not a single neurodiagnostic test from an imaging standpoint that shows us those problems. Everything's normal, okay? Now, we're working on some things, but nothing that's ready for prime time at this point.
Yeah.
But getting back to your question on how we put athletes back to play, there's very specific criteria now. First of all, if an athlete has symptoms of concussion during a game or practice, the athlete is taken out of play for that day without any question at all. If there's any headaches that occur from trauma, dizziness, light sensitivity, noise sensitivity, and it's from trauma to the head, that patient has to be taken out of play for that day and they can't go back to play, period. Mm-hmm. So I don't care if an athlete comes to the sideline and has a headache and he says within 15 minutes it's gone. If that came from a blow to the head and it's concussion-related headaches, that patient cannot go back to play in the same game, period.
Now, that would seem to be relatively easy to enforce with the lower level leagues, high schools, maybe some college, but that would be tough in professional leagues, wouldn't it?
I actually think it's being done better in professional leagues than it's being done at the high school level.
Oh, really? Okay.
In fact, I know that. You know, the NFL, I think, has done it's done a very good job educating everyone. The policies are very clear. And now in the NFL, if someone goes back to play with symptoms and the athlete reported those symptoms, then there's something wrong. They shouldn't be.
Okay.
And that's, you know, I know there's been some situations where you see that occur, but it shouldn't happen. I think it's harder to enforce the high school level because there's just a lack of appreciation, understanding of the subtleties of this. And a lot of high schools don't have athletic trainers. Athletic trainers are critical for this injury. You know, any high school that didn't have an athletic trainer, you wouldn't find my kid at. I can tell you that.
Mm.
You know, athletic trainers are critical for recognition of this and to manage these things. Symptoms preclude return to play on the same day. Now, the criteria that we use for return to play after that is as follows. In order to go back to play, the athlete has to be completely symptom-free at rest, meaning that when they're not working out, they have to have all 21 symptoms of concussion be gone completely. They can't have headaches and dizziness when they stand quickly and fatigue and everything I went over earlier, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
The second criteria is not only do they have to be symptom-free at rest, they have to be symptom-free with full school and physical exertion. So they can't come home from school with a headache. They can't run sprints and have headaches or other symptoms. They can't lift weights and have symptoms and have other headaches. not only do we want to make sure they're symptom-free at rest, but because concussion is an energy problem, we want to make sure they're symptom-free when you really tax the brain for energy, okay?
Right.
The third criteria is that, and this is becoming much more widely implemented, is the use of neurocognitive testing. Hmm. Neurocognitive testing is the only way to measure this injury through quantifiable, objective means.
Is that like the impact testing?
Correct. Impact is a kind of neurocognitive test. It's a computer-based neurocognitive test where that test is administered at baseline. Athletes will take that test at baseline, and then if there's an injury, that test is repeated after the injury, and the results have to be commensurate with baseline. Now, to let you know, there's been nearly 2 million athletes that have taken the impact test at this point. There's extensive normative data. So even without a baseline,
right,
we still have ways of using that tool very effectively. And there's a lot of clinicians across the country now that have clinics set up to do this specifically. And that's really what I recommend is when an athlete has a concussion and they're determining recovery, kids and parents should be going to clinics that specialize in sports concussion management. Now, down in Texas, for example, I know there's a great clinic down there run by Ken Locker, who's a former athletic trainer for the Dallas Cowboys, and Dr. Jim Sterling and others down there in Texas that are phenomenal. They have a great clinic down there. There's many clinics around Texas, and there's many clinics around the country now. I think we've trained, 250 to 400, somewhere around there, clinics who specialize in concussion management and use the impact test and use – and they're up to speed on the advances in terms of how to evaluate this stuff. But I think that's the big message point is when you symptom-free at rest, symptom-free with both school and physical activity, normal neurocognitive functioning, whether it's relative to baseline or relative to norms, and being seen by a clinician that actually knows how to evaluate this stuff. If you do that, you're going to be fine.
So that's a huge message for parents who may have a child that has a concussion, that they really need to make sure that they're seen by a specialist who knows what they're doing.
Yeah, I can't stress that enough. I hear horror stories with kids that go to clinicians that aren't aware of the advances of this injury. I mean, just because you wear a white coat doesn't mean you know how to evaluate and manage concussion. And neurologists, a lot of them aren't trained in this. There's a lot of different professionals that aren't trained in this. You got to make sure you're seen by a clinician that's really specialized in sports concussion management.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, go see somebody who knows what they're doing.
Exactly.
Always a good key.
So, always a good key for anything.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I know there have been some other types of advances in treating concussion, for example, using DHA. What's your take on that?
My take is there's not a lot of science to prove that's effective at this point in time. There's some interest, and there's some animal model work that's been done, but I haven't seen any definitive human-based studies that show that DHA will prevent or mitigate the effects of concussion. Absence of proof doesn't mean proof of absence, and, I take fish oil myself. I don't have a concussion, by the way, but I take fish oil. But I can tell you that something that I think the jury's out at this point, I think more research needs to be done before we make any definitive statements on that.
What do you see coming down the road in the next 5 years in concussion-related research?
Treatment. That's the most exciting part of my day, is we're now doing a lot of work on how to treat this pharmacologically, treating it with medications, we have physical therapy we're creating to treat this, ways of evaluating the vestibular system. The vestibular system is a system we're finding to be particularly vulnerable to this injury because the vestibular system, much like the visual system, is a highly complex system that integrates sensory information in the brain, and we're starting to come up with better ways of assessing that symptom through various in-office evaluations. But treating these problems, I think that's the biggest advance we'll see in the next 5 years is having effective, viable, evidence-based, and I stress evidence-based, treatments and treating and managing this injury.
What can we do to get the word out to athletic trainers and coaches about recognizing symptoms?
I think athletic trainers, by and large, do a phenomenal job. Like I mentioned earlier, I can't imagine a school not having an athletic trainer. They're well trained in this injury. I think that coaches, look, the coach's job is to win games. Mm-hmm. Okay, I respect that. And again, I played sports at a pretty high level. I get it. It's something where, I think we could run into. I mean, look, coaches should be educated on what to look for. if we think a coach is going to be the one determining these decisions and return to play, then we're definitely going down the wrong road, because that's not their job. Their job is to win games. And quite frankly, if I have a coach that doesn't want his athlete back to play, then that's a problem. I mean, coaches, they want the best players in the field, and I respect all that. Get these kids to clinicians that can evaluate it, that can work with the coaches, let them know that when they're ready, and make sure that each high school has a clinic where they can send these kids to. And that's really, I think, the message point that has to occur. But with that being stated, if a coach doesn't have access to an athletic trainer, if they don't have access to a medical professional, I mean, they better be aware of this stuff. And if they're not, then they, you know, run into a lot of problems. And there are good educational programs out there for coaches now. We have a CDC has put together great information for coaches and kids and parents and physicians, et cetera. And if you go to cdc.gov, there's a lot of great educational information on that website.
Super. Yeah, and we'll put that website in the show notes as well.
If we look at this, it also, the impacttest.com website is an excellent website. A lot of good information on there, really good educational information on that website as well.
And I guess just to drive the point home, there are some pretty severe long-term consequences if concussions aren't treated appropriately, aren't there?
Potentially. There's, a lot more science needs to go into studying this phenomenon, but what you're alluding to is something called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is called CTE for short. In theory, that's caused from repetitive blows to the head. My suspicion is that this has happened in athletes that have never been managed for their concussion. And if you look at the individual cases out there where this has occurred, I can tell you that the athletes are playing through their concussions throughout their entire careers. But there is a growing body of evidence that suggests that there may be deleterious sort of long-term effects in athletes that don't have their concussions managed well. And that can take the form of dementia and catastrophic outcomes. It's scary stuff. You got to be careful.
Yeah. Well, being in Pittsburgh, Terry Bradshaw recently came out and said he thought he had at least 6 concussions during his playing career. There are many other examples of that out there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with Terry's situation, but, you know, it's something where certainly there's a lot of athletes that have played through this in the past, and hopefully that will not happen as much anymore, because we're doing a lot better in how we manage and assess this stuff. And it's just about being in a community that's educated and enlightened and has the right tools to use, you know, using neurocognitive testing, having athletic trainers, having a clinic that has the right people in place to see these kids. It takes a village to manage this injury, I'll tell you. And you know, it's something that you need to make sure these things are in place.
I think you got a good bumper sticker there.
It
takes a village to manage a concussion.
Yeah, I don't know. I do enough concussion stuff during the day. I don't need that on my car either.
We're running short on time here, and as we always do, we'd like to give you a chance to give a take-home message for the audience.
My take-home message is that concussion's not the boogeyman. This is a manageable injury. When it occurs, make sure that the right evaluation is done, neurocognitive testing is completed, the athlete's taken out of play, the athlete's seen by a clinician that has training to evaluate and manage this and understand how to use the tools. When that's all done, put the kids back to play, because sports is a wonderful thing for kids, and I don't think I'd be where I am in my life if it weren't for sports. And I think it's very important to understand that this is all about managing an injury. It's not about keeping kids out of sports. And I think football is a beautiful, wonderful thing. And it's just making sure when there's symptoms of concussion, the athlete's taken out of play and the right things are done to get them back to play safely.
Great, great take-home message. I want to thank you so much for joining us here, and I know the audience will really appreciate this podcast. And for those of you listening, thank you for taking the time to download us and listen to us. And don't think we've forgotten about the T-shirt question. So, Justin, do you have a question for him?
Name 3 or 4 symptoms associated with concussion.
So be the first one to email us with the correct answer, and you'll win one of those nifty Huffines podcast T-shirts. Like I said, you better hurry up, because the ones we've got are running out, and the second edition is going to be coming soon. So again, thank you for taking the time to download us and join us today. Thank you, Dr. Collins, for being with us.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
And we hope that you all join us next week for another interesting individual in the world of sports medicine. And don't forget to check out our new video webcast. I think you'll enjoy those as well. Until next week, we hope you have an active and healthy week.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Justin Dobson and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, providing voiceovers internationally. Music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.